I've been, as you know, writing a number of articles, and this is the first of them that I wrote. It is called Only Love. I thought I would begin by reading this. One time, my guru was standing with a small group of us monks. I was about 2 meters from him. As I stood there, I thought, he's over there, in a particular location in space. Yet, at the same time, he's here inside me. How can I understand that in spirit he is not limited, not merely over there, but everywhere? Just as I was wrestling with this thought, he came over to me and, understatedly, without a word, but smiling slightly, gave me an apple. Obviously, he knew what I was thinking. Was he merely playing with me? There was, I think, a deeper lesson involved. I had been telling myself, he isn't human. In his deeper reality, he is spirit. In effect, I had been mentally denying his human reality. What he was saying to me subtly was, the disciple must come to the deeper reality of the guru through the human's humanity. As he knows him, in other words. Philosophically, it is right to say of the guru and of every self-realized master, he isn't human only, he is the infinite self. Indeed, I recall another strange incident which I described in my book, The Path, when I was new on the path and intrigued by the whole idea of astral entities and astral possession. I still recall the dream I had that night. I was at a party, talking casually with unidentified friends, when I remarked to them, it is time for me to go and meet a disincarnate spirit. I left the room and entered another one. I can still remember the room, empty of furniture, with bare floorboards. I stood in the middle of the floor and said, "All right, come on, I want to see what this is all about." Suddenly I felt a presence within me. Om sounded all around me, but it was not a pleasant sound. Rather, it seemed to be the vibration of some lower astral sphere to which the soul I had called belonged. And then I felt myself being sucked out of my body and out of the window into what seemed a gray mist. At this point, I tried to return to my body, but found that it was a struggle. Rather than risk going any further with this experiment, I called out urgently to my guru, "Master!" Instantly I awoke. The unpleasant sound vibration ceased. I was again in normal consciousness. The next morning, Jean Haupt, one of the monks who lived downstairs in the main building, told me, "I was asleep last night when I heard a loud pounding on my door." In astral experiences of this kind, so I am told, the knocking can sound as though over the whole door. It did so in this case.
"Hello! Who's in there?"
roughly demanded a loud, coarse voice.
Me, Jean," was the somewhat fearful answer.
"Who?"
came the same coarse voice. Again, roughly.
Jean Haupt.
"I don't want you," said the voice, shouted the voice. "I want Don Walters."
Jean heard footsteps striding to the outside door, then slamming it. I lived in a separate building on the grounds. Later the next day, I spoke of this episode to Master. He questioned me further, then said, "Don't worry about it. Such experiences occur sometimes on the spiritual path." I was not to be put off, however. How could he have responded so instantly to my plea? And then the next day, ask for details about the experiences. "Sir," I said, "didn't you know about it?" His answer was quite brusque. All he said was, "Once you are one with God, you are God." What an unexpected reply. And how different from the way Tara later edited something Master had said to me about a saint who had once appeared to him in Encinitas. Master had said, "Where God is, there his saints come." Not wishing him to seem boastful, she changed that statement to read, "Wherever a devotee of God is, there his saints come." However, I am a devotee of God, and I cannot claim in any way to have been pestered by such visitations. Indeed, there are two aspects to the spiritual truth. Impersonal, yes, but also very personal. Arjuna, after being given the divine vision of Krishna in his omnipresence, begged to see his guru again in the human form he so loved. And Krishna acceded. He did not say, "Don't you understand? I am not at all that human form." God's impersonality toward us is not that of one who sees us all as insignificant parts merely of an infinite whole, rather than as individual beings individually loved by him. His personality consists rather of not wanting anything from us but our love. It is a giving love, not one that draws selfishly from us toward himself. It is also like the love of a mother who, seeing her child fall and knowing that the fall makes very little, means very little in the child's overall experience of life, yet expresses sympathy sincerely and tries to comfort the child. She accepts as real its experience of that moment while encouraging it to broaden its awareness by embracing a broader reality. Thus, this is what I mean by saying there is also, in a very real sense, a human aspect to our relationship with God. And we come to God through a guru in order that we might clearly understand how all-encompassing is divine love itself. I have known disciples to scoff at the human side of their relationship with the guru, as if to say, "That isn't really at all what it's about." Philosophically, they seem right. Yet, I have also noticed that disciples with this mentally aloof attitude are not the truest devotees. They become somewhat cold and distant. And I have not noticed that their attunement with the guru is thereby enhanced. Rather, it seems diminished. Master, in giving me that apple, was subtly implying, "Love me not in spite of my human nature, my personality, but through them." As Sri Yukteswar wrote in his book, The Holy Science, the devotee cannot advance a single step toward God until he develops the natural love of the heart. It is through love of the Guru, in his perfection as a human being, that human beings can come to understand the love of God, who is beyond even human perfection. And so I'm going to sit down now. And so we have stories like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and they are, in a sense, very human stories. And the consciousness of, and the consciousness behind these great epics is to help us through our humanity to reach up and become God. But it's very interesting to see Rama, who is an incarnation of God himself, his disciple Hanuman can do things even Rama can't do. He has greater power through his faith in Rama than Rama can. I mean, flying from Sri Lanka to Dronagiri to get that herb, we have to understand that there is a very human side to it all. And it's a wonderful thing to contemplate. The longer I've been on the path, the more I come to understand that there's a very human side to God. It's interesting that Master said that we even in a sense, as it says in the Bible, let us make man in our image. And there are two things here that are of interest. The first one is that word us. What is God who is alone and one without a second? Saying, why is he saying, let us make God and make man in our image? The us means that he does everything through instruments. He saves people through saints and through avatars. He even creates the universe through high entities. And this is an aspect of it that is a little difficult for us to understand, but you know, an amazing thing in Autobiography of a Yogi is where Sri Yukteswar speaks of entities on the causal plane, that they have vast powers, even the power to create a whole universe. This is perhaps beyond us. But we have to understand that there is this aspect of outwardness too in God. In the Shastras they say that God created the universe that he might enjoy himself through many. And that's always been sort of a puzzler for me. But I sort of think that it means this, that the very nature of bliss is to want to expand itself, to express itself in forms. And the days and the nights of Brahma are all, they're an aspect of that. But the other side, and it's very interesting, Master, you know, the spiritual eye that you see here at the Kotastha, it has three concentric parts. First is the outer ring. And I'll tell you an interesting thing first. You can't see it from there, but when you get up, look at it. Those of you who can see it. That ring is the spiritual eye. The outer golden ring is the astral energy. The blue on the inside, which the devotee sees, it represents the Christ consciousness, or Kutastha. And the star in the center represents God himself. And Master said that the body of man is actually like a five-pointed star. You put your arms out, your legs out, you've got the arms, the legs, and the head. This is why actually the Chinese symbol of the star upside down is an evil and negative symbol. And this is the true symbol. God doesn't look like that, and yet that is the form of the star through which God came. And this is why in the Christmas story, the wise men say, we have seen his star in the east. And it wasn't a comet up there. In fact, the Shastric statement about comets is that they are inauspicious. We certainly don't want to think that Jesus Christ's birth was inauspicious. However, the interesting thing about that star is that if it were over anything, let's say it were over a building, you go behind that building, it'll be over something else. And no matter how far you go, it'll be over something else. It wasn't that the star came and stood over. What it was saying is that these masters, and Master said they were, Babaji, Lahiri Maharaja, and Sri Yukteswar, which was quite a stunning thing to hear him say. But when they saw the star, they were looking through the spiritual eye, and what they were saying, what it was is a symbol that God incarnated in Jesus, as he did in Krishna, as he did does in all avatars, and that they could see that light guiding them, and over the stable means upon the stable. They saw that light coming. But let's always keep in mind, because as yogis, we want to emphasize this consciousness that we need to become one with him, and we need to go beyond the ego and the little separateness that keeps us thinking that I am here and you were there and you were there. That struggle that I was having with Master in that moment there outside in the parking lot when he gave me the apple. But it's something human too. God loves you as an individual. He loves your soul, but he also loves your you for who you are. So as to say, he loves you from inside yourself. And as long as you yourself see yourself as an ego, he, like the mother with her little child, the child may make mistakes and the mother doesn't scold it necessarily. It at least always looks with compassion at the child. And if the child falls down, often you will see children look up and wait for the mother or father to react. And if the mother says, "Oh, poor child," then the child weeps. And if the mother says, "Oh, that's too bad, Johnny, get up," and then he gets up, it doesn't mean that much. Suffering and sorrow and pain are really mental definitions. I have seen again and again in my life that if I simply choose not to define it as something that should not be, then it isn't. Try this. It really works. I mean, I've had to go through my share of pains and suffering in life. I guess we all do. And I remember one time somebody said to me, "Well, you can write happy songs. You have never suffered." And I said, "It's because I've suffered that I have earned the right to write happy songs." We have to learn through suffering that there is something higher. But what I have seen, too, is that if I expand my identity so that I'm not just identified with this body, for example, but all my life experiences. Or I was born in Romania, I lived in Switzerland and England and America and Italy and India and all over the place. And if I make that my reality, all the places I have been, or if I make the large panorama in which I'm sitting my reality and sort of expand my aura, then really it's amazing how things don't affect me. And that's why I've always had this good fortune that I have never, my opinion of other people has never been affected by their opinion of me. Because I've always had a certain impersonality that way. But when I was thrown out of SRF, of course it was a very painful experience for me, but it never brought me to the point of hating them. I don't know how to hate, but I do remember that I had to think of why should I love? Because it wasn't so easy, but I thought, well, but I find that I am happy when I love and I'm not happy when I don't love, so therefore I choose to love. And in this way, I found that what they did that drove them crazy, because they wanted me to react in some way, but I could not do it. I've always thought well of them, and I've somewhat thought a little less of them, but still they're my sisters and brothers on the path, and that's a lot. So try. Remember, I have talked again and again about the importance of rising above the ego. Rama was a human being. Sita was a human being. And their playing of that drama, same with the gopis and Krishna in Vrindavan. Master said that those gopis, apart from the fact that all of them were married and Krishna was just a child, so it wasn't what many people think, but Master said that the gopis were in fact incarnated rishis who descended to earth to act out that drama. But it's perfectly fine to love God as your beloved, to love God as your mother, to love him as your father, and as your friend. Master used to say, "I prefer the relationship of friend because there's no compulsion, where in a mother there's some compulsion, but in a friend it's free completely." And so, if we think of God in any way, in a human way, I know that when I first heard that God could be worshipped as the Divine Mother, I needed some sort of an image to grapple my heart to. And my mother was too close to me. I remembered her in all sorts of familiar situations. Otherwise, she would have done very well because she was a very fine person. But the mother of my godfather had a very motherly look to her. And I sort of thought of Divine Mother as looking like that. Well, I knew that Divine Mother didn't look like that, but she was also that. You don't have to worry about being too exact in these things. In time, however, I found that just as in that song,
of Ram Prasad's Amar Din. Amondin, that's right. Amondin, ki hobe matara, will that day come to me, mother? Jove tara 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 bole, tara meye porbe tara. Tara 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 bole, tara meye porbe tara. Amondin, ki hobe matara. I forget the rest, but it says at the end, Ram Prasad Rote, Ma Biraja Shorbo Gote, Mother is everywhere. And so, in the end, you begin to see that Mother is everywhere. She's in every flower and every person. And it's a wonderful feeling. As he says also, Ami Jani, Tara Amar Nirakara, she is without any form, and yet I prefer to worship her in this form. And there's a sweet story from the life of Ram Prasad, where one time he was working on his fence, and his daughter, it wasn't his daughter, but it looked like her, and she came up and was sort of playing and teasing him and saying, Daddy, whom are you singing to? And he said, well, I'm singing to that divine mother of mine, but she's very naughty. She won't answer me. And the little daughter said, well, if she doesn't answer, why do you sing to her and keep singing to her? And then she ran away laughing. And he came in and told his wife how their child had come and played with them. And the mother said, oh, no, she couldn't have come. She's on the other side of town. And then he realized it was the divine mother herself. Or it come in that form. Well, Divine Mother plays in human ways with people. And it's a very sweet thing to understand that these stories of Rama and Sita and all of those wonderful dramas and the Puranas and the Mahabharata and so on, there is truth in them in a literal as well as in a figurative way. God is not that, he's much more, but he's also that. And so we should learn to love God in whatever way is dear to us, and then understand that if we ever have a vision of God, let's say of the Divine Mother, in those eyes realize that there is the consciousness of infinity behind those eyes. So thinking of the Guru, think that behind him there is that infinite one. The story of Rama is, of course, one of the most beautiful stories in the world, but I couldn't quite get why it was beautiful. It was just a lovely story, but when I put that book down after reading it the first time, I felt bathed in purity. I felt it was such a uplifting and clean and pure and beautiful story. It was just thrilling. And you will find that studying the lives of this divine Leela of those souls who have come into this world, some of them have played human roles, some of them have played very distant roles, but all of them, in everything they do, as I look back over my Guru's life, I see that again and again, his very gestures, they were symbolic of something more. There was always something more implied in the slightest little gestures. It was, to me, an absolutely incredible Leela. It really was. And like that occasion when I was trying to think, well, he's here, but he's there, and what do I do about it? And he came to remind me he was also there and gave me that apple. So here on Diwali, we should think of it in also a human way, because finally speaking, God creates this universe, as I said, through instruments. And we must remember that if God is to do anything in this world, he cannot do it without us. Yes, there is a war up in heaven even now between the Asuras and the Devas. There is a war between light and darkness. We are living in times of war, And whether that war comes to pass on this world soon or late, it seems to me inevitable. When you think of the hatred, when you think of the violence and the terrorism, you can't think that this will just sort of drift away like a cloud. There's something serious coming up, I think. But the other side of that is that God needs us, and I think we should feel a dedication to asking him to use us as his instruments. I know I felt this very keenly because, after all, when I was a teenager was when World War II was raging in Europe, and I had lived in Europe, and I knew many of my friends were being killed, many of them were being sent to concentration camps, many of them were sent to Siberia by Russia, and it was a very pressing thing for me. And I wanted so much to try to help make this not happen. And I realized that politics wasn't going to do it. Communism wasn't going to do it. The trouble with politics and human methods is that they're made of human beings. And human beings have all the faults of human beings. And so that wasn't how to do it. And I thought, maybe we can inspire people through the arts. But I looked at it. I wanted to be a playwright and a poet, and I was a singer and so on. But I thought, how many people, even Shakespeare, the greatest dramatist, how many people's lives have been changed by him? I thought, I don't know of any. What's the use? And I thought, well, there's got to be God somewhere. And I realized that the goal of life then has to be to know God and to be his instrument. But I didn't know how to go at it. And I found this book called The Short World Bible. And I read excerpts from the different religions. And I found that in the Indian teachings of Hinduism, this was what I needed. This is what I wanted. I saw that it was a religion that didn't depend on a human being, but it was cosmic. And it said that you've got to experience. You can't just... I mean, the world... people used to say the world is flat, but that didn't make it so. When they went around the world, they proved that it's not. We need to prove religion also. And I was very moved by this. But, you know, here's another instance of how God and Divine Mother really do take an interest in our lives. And it may show it in one way. In my case, there was certainly a very divine destiny in my case, but it shows it in every one of our lives. If we will look for it in how many ways God does answer our prayers, little ways, big ways, but he does consciously answer. The interesting thing then was that my father had been posted to Cairo, Egypt, because his job was as an oil geologist. And Esso, whom he worked for, decided they wanted to find oil in Egypt. And then I had to send my mother to join him, and I put her on the boat, on the ship, to go join him. The very day that I put her on the boat, I came uptown New York, and I found Autobiography of a Yogi. There's got to be some sort of divine destiny there somehow. If she had been there, mind you, it would not have been easy for me to change my whole direction in life. Not that I had one. But still, I had never... I didn't know what to do. But I'd never heard words like guru and karma and dharma and all these. I didn't know anything about reincarnation. It was all a complete novelty to me. And 1 year later, 1 week later, I had read Autobiography of a Yogi, and I took the next bus across America. 4 days and four nights. There has to be some destiny there. And when I met Master, first of all, I was told his appointments were all taken up for 2 months. And then I thought, well, I'll just have to wait. And then the secretary came up and said, since you have come so far, I will ask him if he will see you. And when he did see me, his first words to me were, apart after what can I do for you? I said, the first thing I said was, I want to be your disciple. And then he said to me, I saw you because Divine Mother told me to see you. He said, it's not because you've come from so far. There was a lady here 2 weeks ago who came all the way from Sweden, but Divine Mother did not tell me to see her, so I didn't. So you see, Divine Mother takes an interest in your life, and you need to understand that. And the thing that I wanted to say here is that as Rama fought for light against Ravana and darkness, so we need to fight for light. Now, we don't fight for light with swords. We fight with love. When you have, as Master said, you don't get rid of your faults by beating at them with a stick. You can't get rid of darkness by beating at it with a stick. Turn the light on and the darkness will vanish as though it had never existed. And so we need to bring the light into our consciousness. And what we need also is try to radiate that light outward from others. And so what I would like to urge you to do today is think that God is acting in you and through you. So you don't look at people with personal feelings of likes or dislikes, but feel that God is in everybody and try to feel that God is radiating that. We should try to be instruments of that divine love and divine joy. We can be. And the more you try, the more you will find that energy flowing through you. This is a reality. Ultimately, I remember one time, because Master at the end of his life was taking on the karma of disciples and he had trouble with his knees, and so we were helping him into his car. And he said, you are all so kind to me with your attentions. And we said, oh, Master, it's you who are kind to us. Just look what you're giving us. We're just helping you into the car. Master said, God is helping God. That's his drama. We must try to see more and more that it is God acting in everything. The more we can do that, the more we feel a certain freedom from attachment, from attraction, from desires. And we can, in this life, reach that if we will. Try in this day not to hate anybody, even the worst sinners. Try to see that all of them, I've often offered this incentive to loving God, that everybody in the world is looking for the same thing. They may think they want money, they may think they want violence, they may think they want conquest. In the end, everybody is looking for Satchidananda. And they don't know where to find it, and so they think they will get it in these things. And so it takes a few, quite a few, lifetimes. But once you have that, then you know what you were always looking for was Ananda, bliss. So when you see people and they all have so many different bhavs, so many different attitudes in life, think of them as seeking Ananda, perhaps mistakenly, but all of us want the same thing. So how can you not love people who want that one thing, even mistakenly? For that reason, I think the Masters come here and try to help us. God bless you. So?
The Festival of Light.
Festival of Light. Yes, this is a very appropriate thing because I wrote this Festival of Light years ago just as a, when people come to a satsang or a service or a sermon or whatever, you can't be saying the same things every Sunday. And so naturally you talk about other things. And somebody will come to one of our services and go away and people ask them, well, what did they talk about? And he said, oh, they talk about relationships, or they talk about overcoming selfishness or something. But of course we teach much more than that. And yet simply to read what we teach, our basic teachings in a sterile way, doesn't have any upliftment to it. And so I wrote this Festival of Light, and I wrote it in Assisi, actually. And I would like to perform it for you today.